Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, May 18th. Fareed Zakaria is thinking about virtuous cycles and vicious ones. The Washington Post columnist and host of Fareed Zakaria GPS on CNN wrote a column this month called "The Pandemic Has Led to Innovation. It's a Reason for Optimism." He cites a renewed interest and massive investments in science and technology inspired by the epically successful vaccine development as hopefully fostering a virtuous cycle. But this week, Fareed also hosted a CNN special report called "A Radical Rebellion, The Transformation of the GOP," in which he sees a few vicious cycles at work, like Republican presidents from Reagan to Trump promising big conservative changes that never happen, which contributes to the base becoming more radicalized and aggrieved. Fareed was here most recently in October for his book, 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Let's pick up these threads. Always great to have you, Fareed. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. Always a pleasure.
Can we start with your use of the term virtuous cycle in the Washington Post to describe what might be happening in this country right now with innovation?
Sure. I mean, I think we all sense some of it anyway. We're all working in ways that are different. In some ways, are more productive. You lose some things for sure. But that's when innovation happens, you know, when you're forced to adapt, when you're forced to change the ways you do things. We're all creatures of habit, and it's very hard to cast aside the old habits and adopt new ones. So one of the things that's happened in all of our personal lives, in corporate America, and in, you know, in even broader ways, even government, is that we've all been forced to cast aside old ways and find new ones. Not all of them will stay. Not all of them are more productive. But that ability to be open to change is in many ways the essence of innovation.
You also cite a bold fiscal innovation in Europe that's different from the innovation that's happening here. How is Europe innovating fiscally around COVID?
So first, let's take stock of how innovative we have been fiscally. I mean, you know, Biden has really stepped up to the plate, and we are now, for the first time, making major investments in the lives of poor people and middle-class people. I mean, for the time I've been in America, since 1982, every major fiscal effort has been directed toward the rich. That is to say, tax cuts for the rich or wars. This is the first time where the bulk of these measures will actually go to the middle of the income distribution, and some of it even to poor people. The European one is actually more innovative in the sense that, look, it's a bunch of different countries. And the one thing that the rich countries have always resisted is the idea that they would guarantee the debt of poor countries. The mechanism is a little complicated, but basically that is what Germany and France agreed to do in the last year. They'd never agreed to do this before, even in the depths of the 2008-2009 financial crisis. So they have agreed to, you know, a kind of common European project, even when it comes to borrowing and spending. So those are both on both sides of the Atlantic. I think we're being much more bold in the way we're thinking about investing for the future.
In another column, you explore the difference between countries that did well at resisting COVID spread in the first place and those that did not. And your premise is that it's less about the governments of those countries than it is about societies that have what one of your sources calls tight cultures or loose cultures. That'll be a new concept to most of our listeners, as it was to me before I read your column. Can you give us a little remote learning on this concept of tight cultures versus loose cultures?
Sure. You know, it all came out of a mistake in the sense that when I'm trying to figure out in my book, you know, I wrote the book in the first three, four months of the pandemic, and I had to kind of project a lot of stuff. And I look back on it now a year later, and I honestly got mostly everything right, with a few exceptions. And the big one was I didn't catch, I didn't predict that Europe would have such a strong second wave. And so I was looking at it and asking, why did that happen? Because European governments, the public health systems in France and Germany and Holland are very good. So all the things that I had focused on, you know, East Asian governments being good, the American government having been terrible at this, UK government having been bad at it, what was going on here? And what I discovered was that the French and the Germans, for example, really crushed the first wave because of very good, smart government action. But then people just got fed up of, you know, of doing the social distancing. They got fed up of wearing the masks, whether it was August vacation in France or Oktoberfest in Germany. They all began to behave like Floridians, if you want to put it in the American context. Huh. And that produced a huge second wave. And so that led me to the research of Michelle Gelfand, this wonderful psychologist. And she talks about cultures that are tight cultures, where people instinctively follow rules, and loose cultures, where people instinctively defy authority. And it's not a perfect correlation, but you really do find that places like Singapore, South Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, people generally view the collective enterprise as a very important one. Whereas if you look at places like the UK, the United States, Israel, individual action and defiance of authority and hierarchy is a core value. And it turns out in this kind of public health crisis, that kind of individualism is not a great thing because it makes it impossible to do real lockdowns. It makes it impossible to have real social distancing rules and things like that. Now, the interesting final point I make is what I was most intrigued by her work was she points out it's not like these cultures in East Asia are, you know, better or different genetically or anything like that. First of all, there are trade-offs here, you know, the being tight or loose is good or bad, depending on what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. But the tight cultures were all places that in some way faced a sense of external threat, you know, had banded together. Think of Taiwan under the shadow of China, Vietnam having gone through its long war mm-hmm. with the French and the United States, Singapore, this tiny island nation. Yeah. So even New Zealand, the one, you know, a Western country, an island nation. So there is a certain sense in which you can understand why these countries band together and are more tight. And it's not, you know, genes, it's more history and geography and things like that.
And yet the theory goes America's loose culture helped the vaccine get out, but also is defined by, the virus. The America's loose culture, as you were just describing, helped the virus get out, but also is defined by innovation that we were just talking about with the vaccine development. So it's not an all good or all bad comparison.
Completely. You know, clearly the individualism of the West, if you want to put it in very simple terms, is great for innovation, is great for individual expression, it's great for freedom and liberty in many ways. The collectivism of East Asia is probably good for social order. It's good for things like public health responses. You know, there are some areas where collective action becomes very important. Pandemics are probably the single most important one, but there are others. Only the extraordinary innovation and individualism and all that kind of thing of the West probably could get us this miracle of the vaccine, which really is a miracle. I mean, it's, you know, in 9 months we had 5 vaccines. Which, I mean, normally if you'd asked somebody 10 years ago how long would it take to get a vaccine, they would have said 15 years.
Mm. Fareed Zakaria from CNN and Washington Post columnist with us. And we'll get to your special report about the Republican Party. But staying on some of these columns that you wrote and the news, I want to ask where your country of origin, India, fits into this as it becomes maybe the worst tragedy in the whole pandemic. But let me first acknowledge for our audience, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but you've spoken about this publicly, that I read that your own mother died of COVID in India just last month at the age of 85. So, Fareed, please first accept my condolences. And if you don't mind talking about it, I was imagining you feeling kind of helpless, like here you are in a recovering United States and you couldn't stop the plague from claiming your own mother in a country that used to be seen as safer from COVID than the United States. So really my sympathies, but is there anything you would like to say to pay tribute to your mom or to talk about that context?
Well, you put it exactly right in terms of how I felt, which was helpless. Because, you know, at some level, I mean, my mother had a very rich life. She had a wonderful career in journalism, social work, education. She had kids whom she adored, grandkids whom she adored. And she was 85, as you say. And so, you know, it's hard to, I mean, there's a point at which in your life, you know, maybe it's okay that you are going to pass away. But to me, the hardest part of it was not that. It was the fact that here she was going into hospital. I couldn't fly there. I couldn't be there. I couldn't, you know, mourn her death. I couldn't bury her. My kids have gone to India every year of their lives because at Christmas we go and visit their grandmother. And I couldn't take them for this final trip where they would have a chance to, you know, to pay their final respects, to, you know, to kind of close a circle. I found that the most deeply tragic part. I found, strangely, you know, if somebody had said to me, okay, your mother's going to die at 85, she'll have lived a great life, and here's, but you'll be able to do all those things, it would feel very different. And it, I still feel the whole thing is incomplete. I feel like, I never thought of myself as somebody who needed psychological closure. Mm-hmm. But I now realize why, you know, in every tradition, there is something like a Shiva and a Kaddish in the, you know, there is something
Jewish
like that
tradition.
In the, yeah, uh-huh. And that's in the Jewish tradition, the wake, you know, there's always something like that. And I didn't get to do that. And that's my greatest sadness.
Yeah. And again, I definitely feel for you on this. I was shocked to read it when I saw it in the press and, you know, because it's you. And about India as a whole, why do you think the virus is making a late surge after pretty successful containment for a long time at first?
You know, I think this is a case that really dwells on the central thesis in my book, which is state capacity, government capacity. The Indian government doesn't function very well to the extent that people have thought about, you know, the rise of India and heard about it. It's really all a story of the private sector. In the Indian state is dysfunctional. It's corrupt. It's also very weak. It collects almost no taxes. You know, there's all kinds of problems with it. Public health wise, it's particularly bad. India has the lowest number of hospital beds per capita of any major developing country, of any major third world country, let alone, you know, what comparing it to America. So there was always a danger that this would happen. It crushed the first wave. Really, because Modi, quite surprisingly, enacted a remarkably strict lockdown. I mean, it was draconian. I remember talking to friends of mine, relatives of mine. They said grocery stores had closed, pharmacies had closed because the lockdown was so absolute that people didn't, you know, nobody wanted to be on the wrong side of it. So they all took the safer route, which was to shut down. Millions and tens of millions of people thrown into unemployment, but it did crush the wave. Then Modi, this is the Prime Minister of India, gets very overconfident, believes that, you know, he's a genius, believes that maybe Indians are naturally immune or something, and most importantly, he wants to campaign because there are big elections coming up. And so he opens up everything. And, you know, India has enough of a rule of law that if you say, I want to hold campaign rallies which have 50,000 people, well, then you've got to allow cricket games which have 50,000 people. Then you've got to allow religious ceremonies which have hundreds of thousands of people. So all that opened up. And it really is a case of, you know, it's a much, much larger version of what happened in France, for example, when in August everyone went. It turns out, you know, everybody thinks that when the numbers go down, they're special. This is a good lesson for us in life.
Really?
You know, when something happens, you always think you're special and you're unique, and you stop doing the very deterrent measures that made it happen, which were not that you were special or unique, but that you were wearing masks and you were socially distancing.
And as we lift all those restrictions here, we will see what comes to pass. But
the big difference we have, though, is we have a massive vaccination, which you really have to give the Biden administration credit for. So, of course, I'm worried, Brian, but we are, you know, in places like New York City, we're at 50, 60% of the population is vaccinated, 20 to 30% had COVID. So, who knows what herd immunity is, but 80% of the population has antibodies. I'm cautiously optimistic.
And so to this excruciating ethical question that relates, I saw a headline in the Hindustan Times this morning, U.S. will share 80 million spare vaccine doses. Spare vaccine makes it sound like, oh, we don't need them. But President Biden says in the headline, India may benefit, the end of the headline. But the story goes on to say it's unknown how many of those doses India will get and of which vaccines, as opposed to what other countries will get. And I'm curious if you think the U.S. is doing enough, or the global ethics of things like getting American children vaccinated, whoever wants to look away from the safety of their own children. It's a hard thing to ask of anybody, but they are generally a low risk group for serious effects. While India has a 2% adult vaccination rate, I think I read, or something 2 to 10%, something crazy low, and is in this crisis.
You ask a very good question, and I think that the answer is, we should be doing more. And I'm actually a bit surprised that the Biden administration is not taking this opportunity to assert American leadership in an area where the United States has always been the global leader. I mean, the whole idea of international public health, global public health, is an American idea. All the major international global health movements going back to the 1890s were either founded by Americans, or the United States was an absolutely key founding member, including the WHO. So this is a case where the United States could really show that we're back, we're engaged, and it's a classic case of enlightened self-interest. People will benefit enormously. They will see America in a good light, but it also helps us because you can't really get the world back to normal. You can't get global travel back to normal, trade back to normal, without mostly everyone being vaccinated. Everybody doesn't have to be, but we have to have a major push. And so I think that part of what's going on here is the Biden administration is worried about being criticized, you know, by the America Firsters, by essentially Donald Trump and his allies, because the minute he does something, President Biden does something that looks like it's altruistic, you know what's going to happen. People like Trump are going to say, wait a minute, what about Americans? I mean, the truth is there are now more than enough vaccines for Americans. The problem we are facing is not supply, it is vaccine hesitancy. And we should keep pushing and we should keep educating people. But the point is we have enough vaccines for Americans. We are now clearly building up surplus capacity. And we could easily get through a series of smaller measures, whether it's relaxing export controls or suspending patents for a bit. I mean, those technicalities don't matter. The point is, we have the capacity to flood the world with vaccines, and I think it would be a perfect opportunity for America to show we're back on the world stage, we care about the fate of the world, and we understand that our own fate is wrapped up with the fate of the world.
Fareed Zakaria's special report, A Radical Rebellion, The Transformation of the GOP, airs two more times on CNN, Friday night at 11 and Saturday night at 9, and it's available on CNN's digital platforms on demand through May 29th. Fareed's book is called 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World, and you can also read his Washington Post columns. Thanks so much for joining us. I always appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. Great conversation.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.